January 7, 1974, Jim Chubbuck, New Orleans.
McKithen was so popular. See, this is McKithen's greatest achievement, was in getting the people to go along with succession. Since there's been such a history of mistrust of political leaders. You know, if you get a governor, get him 4 years, and then the whole theory was you can only steal so much in 4 years. I mean, people like going around campaigning. It had been tried a number of times. Even Huey Long couldn't change. But he elected his own successor, so it didn't really make any difference to him. He ran the show. But McKithen's greatest political achievement, since of just a real tour de force, was putting that together. And he did that in 60. Got it on the ballot in 1965 as a constitutional amendment. Then it was approved, you know, 2 years before he even had to run.
What caused his loss of popularity?
Ed is really had some of the best appraisal, I think, of McKithen on that, and I think really got to. He was a consensus politician all the way.
Same family than Johnson, especially the consensus you have to deliver, and he couldn't deliver, because when he delivered to A, he had to take it away from B, and then B got mad, so then he tried to give a little bit to C, and then A and B both got mad, and just over a period of a year, everything
disintegrated. See, Johnson had the war, so he had to finance the war as well as all the social programs, and it just got caught in the crunch as well as, you know, tremendous entanglement.
All right, but what would be the analogy in Louisiana to Johnson and the war? What was McKithen's conflict?
Well, probably the Life magazine article.
Life
would be
two things. Life magazine ran a series. Really just one article, and it came back about a year later with another article, implying that the mafia, in effect, had deep inroads in the Louisiana government, and that McKithen, by inference, was connected to it. And then so it sent the McKithen into a tailspin. It's the first real criticism he'd had of any sort. The press, and it was not printed by a local press. It was by Life magazine.
You know? Did they pick it up locally?
Yeah, they did. Oh, yeah, they went running after it like a pack of hounds, didn't they? Because they got embarrassed, they got left out, you see. And so out of that went on, that was ongoing for over a year. Stories about that. They finally had a special legislative committee, which was originally proposed by Gus. He'd hoped to be the chairman of that committee because he hoped to use it for exposure himself, you know, in running for statewide office. He just thought he was going to run for statewide office before that. But they wouldn't give it to him. It went to Adrian DePlanchier, a New Orleans state senator. But McKithen was on the ropes on that thing constantly. And all sorts... They never did show anything about the mafia connection, other than there was some real lax in terms of the way the government was operated, but it showed a great deal of favoritism to political friends in the revenue department, that they weren't collecting taxes on a number of favored friends of the administration. And that became people could understand not paying taxes a lot easier than they could all the amorphous nature of the mafia. The other thing was, he didn't have enough money to pay off on a lot of the social program, the things that he proposed. In fact, McKithen kept wanting to cut back taxes. Then he finally realized he had to raise taxes. So he had to go about it right at the time of the election. He called a special session to raise taxes, and the legislators traditionally never vote a tax increase when they got to go into an election. So he lost that. Even though he won re-election just the year before that with what, 87% of the vote? 82% of the vote. So he couldn't get it, he didn't have enough money to really deliver on some of the promises he'd made to, you know, in terms of programs to a lot of the people.
So Kennan's constitutional amendment requiring a two-thirds vote of the legislature to raise taxes. Is that what prevented McKithen from getting
McKithen
the tax
increase? McKithen could get a majority. He could not get the two-thirds. He finally got it later, but it was too late then. He was on his way down then. And then the other thing that that finally affected McKithens in terms of his personality was that he wanted to be vice president. He really felt he had a chance to be Humphrey's selection. Every time Humphrey would come to the state, McKithen would go all around the state with him, praising him, you know, showing him off everywhere. And Humphrey would say, Lewis, you people got one of the greatest governors in America. It was a superb example of two old con men conning each other, you know. Humphrey had no intention of ever having McKithen as the vice presidential nominee. And I'm shocked that McKithen, you know, felt he had a real shot at. McKithen didn't understand the first thing about national politics. He was just playing games. But Ed has some posters. Ed was at the 68 convention. He had some. I'm sure McKithen burned all of them, but yeah. Ed still has one that says McKithen for president. He's going to be the favorite son, you see. And then after Bobby Kennedy's assassination, as you know, everything just totally turned around. Then you had a whole different kind of ball game then. And then, because Humphrey, there was no way I thought Humphrey would lose it then, so he had more options on what he was going to do. So McKithen came home early. He left that convention very disgusted, disgruntled, upset, because nobody's paying him any attention. Came back to Louisiana, refused to, you know, the press wanted, because, and the press really went after him a bit, too. Refused to say who he was going to vote for or anything. After here, he was trying to be the vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party. So he just lost face with a lot of people in the state. And also, I think McKithen had made so many enemies over that intense period of getting, you know, putting together his succession thing, that once he started losing face, he just, things started happening on top of the island.
Why do you think it worked to his own detriment in the second term?
No, I'm saying, I think that the succession, I think, that McKithen put that thing is going to work a detriment to the political system.
Oh,
not to any individual.
Why?
I think, because with the way Louisiana politics is operated, you know, with the governor being the single, almost powerful figure in the state, there's nobody even close. You know, we don't have a strong legislature, and then it just depends on the most of the other statewide offices just really stay out of the governor's way and don't provide any competition to
it. Is this a distinctive feature of Louisiana politics, the power of the governor's office?
I think it is.
As opposed
I think,
to the rest of the southern states?
I don't think any other state has, this, in terms of institutionally, has a governor's office as strong as Louisiana. Wallace is very strong, but I think it's a personality.
What are some of the bases of institutional strengths in Louisiana that differ from the other southern states? One, he can run for a second term.
Well, they didn't have that before this last
right.
time. I think that just makes him even more powerful. The tremendous appointed power all the way down the line. I think the governor, I don't know, it's still over 1,000. At one time, he used to personally appoint about 2,000 or 3,000 people all over the state. He used to appoint vacancies in every single elective office in Louisiana.
What does he appoint now?
He still appoints vacancies if they have a short, but it's only a short period. He appoints all the judges now, but almost any new judges are created, he appoints that carte blanche. But some of the vacancies are now appointed by local governing bodies if it has more than a year to run. If it's less than a year to run, the governor still appoints. He used to appoint the inheritance tax collector, which is a marvelous patronage tool that I doubt any state has, although that it finally supposedly went out of business on January 1st of this year.
Who else does he appoint now besides judges? He still appoints.
Well, he still appoints. He has a number. See, this, he has a number.
Members of all the boards and commissions of the state.
Louisiana runs on boards and commissions.
Power keeps up with how many there are whenever you go up there. 375 or 411 or something like that. It's hard to keep track as they increase several a year. But so
it's like Board of Education, Higher
no,
Education.
No, he doesn't do that.
The Board of
Higher Education. Board of Highways. The highway system is totally run by the governor. The Board of Health,
yeah.
You know, the health and hospitals and all that's totally run. There's a board, the governor appoints and he controls it.
All the institutions.
Wildlife and fishing.
Conservation and minerals and oil.
For institutions, you mean colleges?
No.
The LSU board he appoints.
Health institutions, penal institutions, that kind of institution. You know, special institutions for the.
But does each penal institution have a separate board or
no.
is there.
No,
Department of Corrections.
No, there's one. There's a Department of Correction that has a Board of Corrections, and the governor appoints every one of those members of the Board of Corrections. And he can, even though that...
he appoints the welfare board.
He appoints the welfare board.
But see, education is different.
Education is elected.
The LSU board is appointed. The super board is appointed.
The what board?
The super
board.
Wait,
that's not... We're jumping around too much. The LSU board, which runs LSU system, is appointed by the governor. Totally. He has a majority of it now. The State Board of Education, which is an elected 11-member board, elected from districts around the state, runs the other, all the state colleges and state universities outside of LSU, and they supposedly oversee the secondary school system, but there is a state superintendent of education who is primary authority for that.
Who's elected
also.
Does she report to that Board of Education,
yes,
elected superintendent?
He is the ex officio secretary of that board, and there's usually always a fight between them going on. But they've drawn up sort of a gentleman's agreement going on for the last 30 years, I guess, where the state board appoints all the presidents and has all the things dealing with the contracts with state colleges and universities, while the superintendent has everything to do with the high school and trade schools.
Does the governor have any appointive powers within the legislature?
Well, within the legislative budget committee, they've made some changes in that, but the governor appoints the members of the budget committee. And they still appoint the members? Yeah. They made some changes in it during Edwards' administration so far. And I'm not sure exactly, but prior to that, I know the governor appointed every member. They appointed that they were listed how many had to be from the Senate and how many from the House, and you had certain ex officio, like Senate Finance and House Appropriations, you know. But other than that, the governor appointed them. The legislature, up until 2 years ago, created all innumerable interim committees. The governor invariably appoints the members of those interim committees. The Superdome Investigation Committee is appointed by the governor. Kiefer was appointed by that. On education also, the Super Board Ed was mentioned. That's a new board that's supposed to oversee all higher education. Since you have two different boards, they were trying to find a new board to sort of oversee it, but it really doesn't operate them. But the governor appoints those members, all right? Every state contract that's let, state contract, you know, by a state agency. And you have to remember there are many other agencies that operate in Louisiana that are not exactly statewide agencies. You have what we call in this state levee boards, which are responsible for maintaining levees along various rivers in the state to protect from flooding. The governor appoints all the members of that. Those are state agencies, and they give contracts, and they have taxing authority. The governor appoints every one of those guys. For every contract let by a state agency, there's usually an architect, you know, for any kind of construction, there's an architect. Every architect in the state for a state contract or state agency contract is approved by the governor.
The architect is approved by the governor?
Yes.
And the engineer.
And it almost guarantees sufficient campaign funds for any governor running for re-election. That appointment alone.
You think you're going to be moving into a two-term tradition?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm afraid of. Ed thinks there's a possibility that because of the way the politics of the state is changing in the sense of there's a great deal more competition now between North and South Louisiana. Traditionally, the North Louisiana guy always won. Now, the South Louisianans really have most of the offices. We feel there's going to be a number of North Louisiana candidates for a number of these offices, you know, to get back into the swing, to divide it up more. But, and also, Edwards only won by, you know, less than 5,000 votes. He's a highly controversial figure. Edwards is capable of being on top of the heap and down the bottom just like that because of his personality. You know, he makes flippant remarks, but he's a very shrewd individual, and he does know how to protect his own skin. And most of the people around the governor want him to stay in 8 years. You know, I mean, 8 years is a lot of people do very well in 8 years. So because of the fact that the elections also cost so much money in Louisiana. See, Louisiana is another factor of Louisiana politics that I don't think is true in any other state. I doubt in any other state that has, you know, comparable size of Louisiana, what, 4 million people in it, would have at a governor's race that they usually would cost between $1 million and $1.5 million. Each candidate, you know, major candidate to win on.
You're talking about the campaign expenses.
The campaign expenses.
Where does it come from?
Comes from contractors, architects, all interests.
Jim, can you say categorically that more money is spent for statewide campaigning in this state than any other southern state?
I would say Texas may be an exception because it's so much bigger and so much more money. But on the terms of a comparable size or per capita basis, I have no doubt nobody does.
Why is that?
Again, it's in the culture, I think, the political culture of the state. That because
are you talking principally about governor, or are you talking about all statewide offices?
Well, most statewide offices, people hang on to them year in, year out. See, another reason why there's such a big change in this last election, you kicked out a lot of figures who've been in, you know, there are a lot of new figures all the way down the line. The lieutenant governor usually is not a very powerful figure in the state and seldom ever succeeds to the governorship. So we had a guy who was lieutenant governor for 12 years. You know, we had an attorney general who was in for 16 years. And he can, so, and some of the others, Wade Martin, Secretary of State, has been in since 1944. He's been in, he'd be 30 years now. So you have some of these lesser statewide offices, they almost become, legal term when you're in an office so long?
Sinecure?
Yeah, like a sinecure. You know, I mean, it just sort of belongs to them.
But then the money is spent principally in the gubernatorial.
Money is spent for governor and some of the legislative races.
There's a reason for governor, though, primarily because the governor simply has so much power.
The governor is the single most powerful figure. If you don't know, you know, in some states you have countervailing forces. In Mississippi, the legislature is an institution that's stronger than the governor. I would say that's true in a lot of other southern states, you know, with the traditional distrust of the governorship.
How are the legislative leaders selected, the Speaker of the House?
Well, this time around is the first time in living memory that the governor did not select by fiat who the speaker was. The guy who got elected for it was a young guy who had only been in the legislature, 4 years? In the House, 4 years, which is unusual. Most states.
What's his name?
Bubba Henry. He's the next, E.L. Bubba Henry. He's the next, considered the next strong, powerful politician from North Louisiana. I think he's on your list there. I think he's pretty well.
Where is he from?
He's from Jonesboro, which is the area where Jimmy he started campaigning for the office during the gubernatorial campaign. He didn't have any opposition. He knew he was going to get back in without the problem. He started campaigning among other individuals who felt would be back again, legislators. And he was also had an arrangement with another legislator from South Louisiana. The story was that if the South Louisiana governor won, then the South Louisiana candidate for speaker that would pull out and would throw his support to the North Louisiana candidate, which was Henry. If the North Louisiana candidate won, which was Johnston, then the North Louisianans would work for the South Louisiana candidate, who was in the South Louisiana member of the House. But it turned out that they worked, that's what happened. When the South Louisiana candidate won, the guy who was going to run as well pulled out, and so Henry was the strongest figure running. And Edwards had very little choice in the matter, although he could have fought and he would have won. I have no doubt in my mind that Edwards, the governor, would have won. The governor normally, up until then, the governor of the legislature doesn't even nominate anybody until the governor goes in and says, this is my candidate for speaker. Then they all automatically select whoever that is. But this is the first time it's happened. Now, how long? Whether that's going to be a trend, I don't know. The president pro tem was the same thing. It's always selected by the governor, and it was this time, too. He decides not to run for governor five years from now, because he won't run against Edwards this next time up. I don't think Henry's going to run for governor in this coming time. But I think he will run, the following time. If he doesn't run, decides he wants to remain speaker, then he's able to keep his job, regardless of who gets elected governor. Then you have the trend may start then.
But you think he will remain speaker for 5 more years?
I think so, unless he runs against Edwards. I don't think Edwards will change the horse. I don't know about what you think, Ed, but I don't think so.
I don't know how he's doing with Edwards. I presume it'd be more difficult for Edwards to change the horse.
Well, he also
is a speaker of a powerful position.
Oh, yeah. So it is in the sense he appoints. He appoints all the committees.
But then the governor traditionally told the speaker which committees he could appoint.
And the governor also, even with there is more flexibility in the legislature, and since they're more the so-called reformers in there now, trying to reform the procedures, make the legislature stronger, but that's only a small number of people. The governor always has his committee. In this administration, it's Ways and Means, which is, you know, usually a powerful committee anyway. But the governor, but a majority of the people appointed to that committee were committed to do whatever Edwards wanted. So every major administration bill goes to that committee. So it's going to come back out. As you know, from your coverage legislature, the committee system is where the kings are killed or put out. And once you get on the floor, you got a different ball game. So I think, you know, the Louisiana legislature is a very weak institution, and I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. They made some changes in the number of committees. They're making the standing committees operate between sections now. That's new. They've cut down on the number of committees. Supposedly, they're trying to get more money for staff and what have you. And in the Constitution Convention that's going on now, the only article that they really improved considerably, well, they improved two. They improved the Bill of Rights article, I think, was improved considerably what it was. But the only other one substantively improved, I think, was the one on the legislature. They did improve the procedural article for the legislature in the Constitution.
In what way?
In giving them a little bit more ability to operate as a unit separate from the governor if they want to. It's still going to be up to them to do it.
How will the state differ politically?
Percentage of the population is Cajun?
About 40.
Oh, yeah. I'd say it's less than that now, yeah.
Hard to tell, see, because one of the Cajun and one Irish, you see. Like Landrew isn't a Cajun, but isn't. It depends how you define it.
He's Creole rather than Cajun. So it's.
Well, what percentage is French?
Around 40-some percent.
What is a Creole by definition?
Well,
how do you define it?
That's where you get a big argument. Creole is usually have been considered the people whose descendants came directly from France or Spain. You know, you can trace your descendants directly back there, you know.
Is it better to
Cajuns
look
came from Acadia, you know, from Nova Scotia.
Some people claim the Creoles, however, are people who are
who have mixed heritage,
white.
Yeah.
Depends who you talk to when you use that term.
First, an essential difference is culture, and that would take in, you know, the political, the just a basic cultural difference. You have language, religion, and race. You have, you know, you
well,
have.
Well, that's also ethnic, because that's related
and ethnic,
to language.
Yeah.
Also, as a footnote, and although I think an important footnote, is the food.
Yeah.
Dramatically different food than any other southern or northern state. A unique cuisine.
You have such an ethnic difference. You have ethnic politics in Louisiana that you don't have. I don't give ethnic politics in North Carolina if you take blacks out, do you? But if you can take blacks out in Louisiana, you still have ethnic politics, you see.
You mean Anglo-Saxons and French?
Yeah, and blacks and Italians. And in New Orleans, you have a strong Italian community, also some of the small towns.
And New Orleans politics is much different than Shreveport white politics or Lafayette white politics.
Yeah.
But, Jim, if you took race out of it, would this state look a lot different from the other southern states?
Yeah.
Putting the race in makes it that one common denominator.
I think race is the biggest common denominator
in terms of
politics between this, because, you know, because of the Civil War and being a southern state and having large numbers of blacks, that keeps it a southern state. But if you took race out, the rest of the things, if you took, you know, in the state overall from Alexandria south, you'd have a totally different kind of politics.
In terms of economics
is another thing, because this is a
mineral
rich state.
Salt.
It's a mineral state.
So except for Texas, Louisiana is the only other mineral rich state in the South.
That's right. Yeah.
So in terms of importance, is there a difference between oil, gas, and sulfur politically?
Yeah, the regulation of it.
All right, who regulates it?
The state regulates a great portion of it. And then the other, and then one other way it's regulated is by local government if they have units, you know, if they have industries within that local government. Like Leander Perez's great power came from the tremendous wealth of Plaquemines Parish, and he regulated the sulfur industry and the oil industry within, at least for those who were drilling operating in the parish. But there is a state tax, severance tax, where we get most of our money, our state tax money. Most of our money comes from oil and gas, and you know the severance on oil and gas in Louisiana.
It's not most in the sense of one half, but it's the largest single
source. It's the largest single source of funds. At one time it was more than that.
How about sales tax?
Sales tax would be the second biggest.
4%.
They just removed one off of it. See, we just increased our severance tax. The governor just increased our taxes by $300 million. But we're supposedly not supposed to pay a nickel because it's on the oil and gas industry, and 80% of our gas is shipped out of state, you see.
All right, the governor just reduced the sales tax. Is that correct?
Well, he reduced it off of food and drugs, the state tax.
State.
But you have, but local, see,
how
the
much
sales tax is the largest single source of money for local governments, the sales tax and the property tax.
How much was it on food and drugs?
It was five.
It's five. Well,
it depends what parish you're in because you can see.
You have 2%.
How much was the state tax on
it's
food?
2%. 3%. It's 3% state tax.
3% state tax.
And that's
now
what
it's 3% state sales tax except on food and drugs.
See, he didn't remove it. He just moved it off an item. He didn't take it off. Then in New Orleans, you have 2% sales tax, or 3%, 2 or 3%. I can't remember. I think it's 6 cents.
Ours
is 6
cents.
So the 3%,
two
for the city. So you have local. See, there are the local taxes on top of it. Some places you'll have 6 cents. Some places 4 cents. Some places 5 cents.
You see. Everybody has three for the state, one for the school board.
So everybody has one for the parish and one for the school board.
Right.
Is there an income tax?
Yes.
Yeah, but it's really insignificant in terms of total money because the rates are so low.
Is there corporate income tax?
Yes.
Yeah, but the rate is very low.
Corporate and personal have low rates.
Well, it's 2, 4, and 6%.
But the tax structure is also a very unique, is a unique feature of Louisiana in terms of Southern politics. It's the only Southern state that derives its chief tax revenue comes from minerals.
Well, Texas most.
Yeah.
Texas does not.
Texas has high property tax.
Right. Texas
no
doesn't tax oil. That's the issue.
See, Texas doesn't tax oil. Well, Louisiana does, in sense of the, but it's very low up until. See, Edwards, see, they needed to raise it. We had a very low severance tax, considering the amount of you know production that goes into. Considering the fact also that's your biggest source of income.
Well, did Edwards run into a big fight on that?
No, not at all, because he tied it to the energy crisis.
Yeah.
But did the oil people didn't fight it?
No, because they didn't know what to do. They got totally caught. He outmaneuvered them. They got caught.
Did they fight? Did Edwards, was he opposed in the election by the oil people?
No.
No, they divided between.
He's an oil lawyer, Edwards.
The oil industry traditionally supports more than one horse.
Why do you think Edwards did this?
Money. He wanted to have a lot more. He could see under the situation he had, he was not going to have enough money to really do a lot of capital expenditure programs.
What does he
traditionally
want to
do? A governor spends a lot of money for capital expenditure, building roads and building. Edwards has promised to build, you know, really to pave over a lot of those bayous in South Louisiana, in effect, to build a lot of roads in South Louisiana. He needed more money for that. He didn't have enough money for that. And so he had to have a way in which to do it. The energy crisis just came along at a very appropriate time for him. So he was able to tie raising the severance, saying we're going to eventually run out of our oil and gas. They're stealing it from us and taking it up to keep those Yankees warm up north. And so, all right, if they're going to steal our gas, let them pay for it. So everybody said, hooray. And the oil industry didn't know quite what to do because to be against it means we're not good citizens, you know, because we need to do something about keeping the income for our people down here. And secondly, he had a bill in there to create a super energy agency that was gutted before it was over. In fact, it was so strong it went in, which it could even abrogate contracts, which most of us felt would go to court and get thrown out, but the oil industry was frightened to death over it. So I think that they spent most of their time trying to find a way to gut that bill, and they finally got an agreement with Edwards. Once they passed the taxes before they did it, in fact, they passed the
Was that bill
they passed the expenditure of that tax money before they passed the tax to be sure they could get it through. And then nobody could oppose it then.
Was that other bill, in your opinion, a cover for his tax program?
Yes, I'm convinced.
To divert attention from the oil companies?
They still passed it, but would greatly reduce powers. I think it was just a cover for it. I don't think he had any, you know, he can still, the main thing he can do now is build pipelines. You know, build pipelines within the state. You see, where Louisiana got screwed on the allocation of gas was that United Gas is our biggest single supplier. And they co-mingle Intral with intrastate gas, and now they couldn't tell at all what to do, so the Federal Power Commission came in and took over the whole thing. And then the United Gas preferred to be regulated by the federal agency than the state agency. Because Louisiana has a fairly active, politically active regulatory agency because it's been a springboard for a number of individuals who run for government.
Well, another distinctive feature of Louisiana politics is the level of public service, which is generally higher than other southern states.
Expenditures
for public service.
Well, Louisiana spends a lot of money.
And they aid the dependent children on 47.
In education, we spend more
money. The only one of the social services we're average or above in, to my knowledge, is age 65 and over.
Yeah, but in per capita expenditures for welfare, it's way up. I don't know.
Well, I don't know how that could be. I mean, you could find out all those figures, but on par. If we're 47th in aid of dependent children, we're some 40th or 30-something in one other category, I don't see how we could be.
No, well, Pierce argues in his chapter that for expenditures for health, education, and welfare, it's much higher than the national average.
Oh, and the education.
It is for education, and it is.
All government.
And it is for. Yeah, I think it is.
And for welfare among southern states is what I'm saying. It stands out.
Well, Louisiana's a rich state in terms of resources. It just squanders so much of the money. It also has more state employees than any other southern state, per capita than any other southern state, too.
How does it squander the money?
Waste money, I think, through a lot of it. It costs more money to build a mile of highway in this state than any other state. And they can't tell me it's just because of the swamps out here. It's because of the whole arrangement of so many middlemen to get into the contracts, you know.
Was that tied in with just campaign financing?
I think it's tied in with the legal graft, you know, that goes on.
In the last 10 years, we've built highways twice.
Yeah.
One out in front of the Capitol and from the highway department, we built twice. All the bridges on the interstate, the expressway going here, we built twice. All of the bridges on the interstate between Lafayette and Houston, we built twice.
What do you mean you built them twice?
They built them, and then a year later, they close it down and build over again.
Because they fall apart.
You build them all over again. The road between Crotch Springs and Opelousas was built over a period of 15 years.
It took 15 years to build about a 20-mile stretch.
And now they're
redoing it. They've on the third time. Fixing over the one of the bridge parts.
What's Russell Long's influence in Louisiana politics?
Oh, it's really more the sort of the sugar daddy in Washington. He's, you know, the big influence that they go to make sure try to get federal money or to keep things from happening.
Keep
in terms
indictments.
But as far as influencing the politics of the state in the sense of elections, I'd say it's very minimal. But I'm not sure he's only tried twice that I know of, and he got burned both times.
He tried
in 1952 to elect Hale Boggs governor. And if that had happened, you really may would have had the state politics would have changed at a much earlier period than what he found. Because Hale Boggs was a precursor to Morrison and Edwards in terms of the South Louisiana Catholic politician. But they lost out then, so Russell Long stayed out of it then for about another 10 years, and he got involved in trying to elect Gillis Long in 1963. And he lost that one. Because McKithen really thought he was going to get all the support of Russell Long and all the Longs. A long split that year, just like they did it in 1952 when the time that he backed Hale Boggs. That's the only time I know that he split. I mean, that he's gotten involved is during those two splits. I think he could raise a tremendous amount of money for whoever he wanted to in any office in Louisiana. But I'm not sure he has, other than for those two times he got
involved.
Has he
just shown no inclination to control state politics?
I don't think he got it, none whatsoever. I don't think he got, I think he originally hoped to. I think when he got involved, see, when he got elected in 1948, see, in that close special election with against Kennan. And then when he ran for re-election, he has, in fact, he's only had one election. That was when he won the first time, the special election. He hasn't had, there's just been minor opponents since then. And then once, then I think he wanted to be a big power in the state politics at that time. That's the first, you know, the first 4 years that he was in. And the reason he got involved in 52. But he broke with Uncle Earl. Uncle Earl went with Carlos Spaight. And Russell Long went with Hale Boggs. If they'd have gotten together with Hale Boggs, Hale Boggs would have made, probably could have made that runoff against Kennan. Now, who would have won that? I don't know, because Kennan got a tremendous vote in New Orleans. But after that time, Russell stayed out of it and just didn't pay much attention to it. And then the word was that he was going to come back to Louisiana in 1963 and run for governor. See, there's been a feeling that Russell Long always wanted to be governor, to come back and be the governor to end out his political career, because his father had been governor. So there were really strong stories going around, and also there seemed to have been, I don't even go back and read some of the clippings, and there seemed to be some basis to the stories, that he really was seriously considering it. But right in late in that spring, or maybe in early, I can't remember now, Senator Kerr of Oklahoma died. Remember Senator Kerr, the most powerful man in the Senate at that time after Lyndon Johnson left. And Kerr was the chairman of the Finance Committee, about the same age as Russell Long. Figured to live longer, you know, than he did. And so Russell Long felt he'd always be, you know, number two and never get the power. So, but once he died, Russell Long moved up to be chairman of the Finance Committee and decided not to run for governor. It's obvious then. But then Gillis Long had gotten elected to the Congress the fall prior to that, and I think because of all the maneuverings that had gone on, I think Russell Long then felt, since he's moving in to be chairman of the committee, and now was the time to really make a move in terms of state politics. And he went all out for Gillis. Gillis could not have run for governor in 1963 if Russell Long had not gone all out to raise the money. Of course, I think near the end, Russell Long actually got on the stump and campaigned at the end, too, which I think was a dreadful mistake. I think that also, you know, helped create the problem for Gillis when he couldn't win it. But that's the only time.
Why did that hurt him?
Because the stories that were going around by the opponents particularly were saying that Gillis Long could be Russell Long's puppet. Well, when Russell Long came down and started going on the stump and campaigning with Gillis, all you had to do was go out there and see that, you know, that Russell Long was top billing and the candidate for governor came in and made his speech afterwards. I mean, it seemed to imply, really. I don't think that would have happened. But the implication clearly was to the voters then. Anybody who wanted to see
it. Anybody was to confirm.
Yeah, right. So I think it really hurt Gillis at the end there. But Gillis could not have raised the money to finance that campaign without Russell Long. He just could not have. But I don't think Russell Long, I know Russell Long did not get involved. He finally made peace with McKithen. See, McKithen expected to get the endorsement and all that. And then I know for a fact that he didn't get involved in this last time around. So he's just let it go. He's never really participated in it, you know.
Russell Long's opposition to Nixon's family assistance program, was that considered a surprise at all here in view of Huey Long's share of the wealth program?
No, not if you go back and read... See, Russell Long's been a bug on the welfare program ever since he's been, you know, going back some years ago. But remember when he had the made the statement about the brood mares? You know, the government was paying money for the brood mares and all this, you know. He's really had some harsh things to say about the welfare program over a long period of time.
What?
I don't know. I don't know fully all why. I really don't understand that, you know.
You say Russell Long is very conservative. How is this manifested?
I think in terms of economic conservatism, you know, he's very closely related to the oil interests, and I think he would find be one of the strongest supporters of the oil industry it has, really.
Very few people with $100 million except Stuart Mott are very liberal.
Now Russell Long's one of the richest men in the Senate. Probably is the richest man in the Senate. He's assumed to be worth at least $100 million in this state.
How did he get the money? How did he become a wealthy?
From his father.
State land oil leases.
State oil leases to a firm that was set up in the mid-30s called the Win or Lose Oil Companies. It never lost. And it had very lucrative gas and oil discoveries on the land. And it was a corporation that was set up by some friends of Huey Long. Huey Long was a silent partner in it. And then after his death, that his holdings went to his two sons and his daughter and his wife, you know. And the Texaco Oil Company was just a small little company until they got the leases on from Win or Lose. And that's what, you know, it's a tremendous oil find. They've sold a great number of those over the years, but he has great, you know, holdings, and, you know, he's a very wealthy man.
You attribute then his conservatism to his wealth?
I think partly that, partly that just his natural political inclination over the years. I've never seen, you know, he's on his voting record. I would never say that he's been, you know, voting, you know, had a very liberal voting record at all, almost anything.
Would you say, would it be reasonable to assume that the only reason he got elected to the U.S. Senate was because he was Huey Long's son?
No, I think the only reason, well, yeah, that, and the other reason was that even if that had been, even with that, he wouldn't have won unless his uncle hadn't been governor then. No, I thought, and Earl Long was the other, in terms of Earl Long and McKithen came out of the Long. You know, Earl was governor, you know, of the period, 48, 52, you know, the start of the period, and then right in the middle, 50, you know, from 56 to 60. Earl was an activist governor, spent a lot of money, do a lot of things, you know, cause a lot of trouble, constantly on the move, something going, something happening. He believed in spending money, you know. I think, who was it called? I guess it was Sinlin called him buccaneering liberalism, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the term.
I think Sinlin is what called him a buccaneering liberal, and because he was a, you know, just such a swashbuckler sort of guy, you know. And yet, he was a real liberal spender in the sense of government programs. He wasn't that interested in how neat things were organized as the fact that you spend the money to get something done, you know. I think Earl overall was a far better governor than the critics gave him, because he was a free spender. They said he wasted the state's money, you know. But if he hadn't spent the money, all the things wouldn't have been done, you know. He consolidated. He created the trade school system, which still has yet to fully do what it's supposed to, but at least gave another route. He brought in the free lunch program for the school lunch, you know, so more people, you know, the poor people could afford to send their kids to school.
Well, some people claim that Sam Jones brought in the free lunch, but Earl made it bigger.
Really? Oh, in turn, he tried to raise taxes three times. He did finally in 48, but he couldn't raise it. Then he tried again in 56 on the severance tax, and he wasn't able to do it. But those are the, I think, in terms of social program, he increased considerably the amount of money that was spent on social programs, welfare, hospitals, education.
In that 25 years, he stands out
He's the only liberal governor. If you look at state government in terms of expenditure of money and what did the government spend the money for, I think you'd clearly say that he was that he was more liberal in his sense of how he spent the money. He also was far more attuned to making the politics being all-inclusive. You know, blacks, whites, Cajuns, rednecks, it didn't matter to him. He just wanted them all in as long as they'd vote for him. So there was absolutely no racism whatsoever in his kind of politics. You know, as long as they voted for him, he was all for them. You know. While
his coalition is basically a coalition of the poor, is that right?
His coalition essentially was labor. It was a coalition of white labor and blacks. You know, the laboring, the lower middle class, the rednecks. He never did well in the cities, you know, other than in the labor and black precincts of the city. You know, labor, you know, white labor. You know, you don't have, in terms of unions, they were much stronger now than what they were then. But his coalition essentially was the lower middle class white and blacks. But the blacks weren't that big then. See, they weren't that big a factor. He basically, and he spent money on education. You know, he let the, you know, he let them alone in terms of running LSU. You know, so many governors have mingled in LSU's affairs. LSU was still the big thing. You have numbers of other institutions now almost as big in terms of the, some of the money they're expending, the student body, whatever. But Earl left them alone. He essentially had fairly good administrators and left them alone, let them run the show. You know.
How would you describe the other governors right now?
Kennan, I think, was a classic of the Annie Longs, of all the Annie Longs, the classic good government conservative. That, you know, that government essentially is a caretaker function, you know, not to get in the way of free enterprise, and not to spend, that the people should spend, you know, should take care of themselves mostly, that the local government should run their own show, that you shouldn't have too many taxes, you should, he tried to eliminate a lot of the patronage that the that had been true of the Long kind of government, or any kind of free spending, free wheeling government. We have a lot of patronage. He eliminated, you know, Earl Long eliminated civil service, and Kennan put civil service back in. Earl had raised the taxes, and so he wanted to make it more difficult. They wanted to make it more difficult to raise taxes, so they put the two-thirds rule in. They wanted to eliminate supposedly the governor's total control over highways and welfare and all the agencies. So they created, under Kennan, they created constitutionally some special blue ribbon boards, that you had special boards of the blue ribbon citizens around the state to run the government. The governor couldn't do it. Well, that never worked.
You say that never worked.
It never worked because, in the first place, the presumption was that you appoint these people, the governor would appoint them,